Hello, I'm Monkon McGann, and you're very welcome to the Big Adventure Podcast.
Joining me from a studio in Santa Monica, California, is a former big game hunter who made a Damascene conversion to wildlife conservation in Nepal. Peter Byrne, you're very welcome to the programme. And Peter, you're Irish.
Yes, I'm Irish. I was born in Donnybrook, Dublin, and brought up in Ireland. So, pretty Irish, yes.
It's a very Irish question to ask as a first question, but it's just looking over your life and hearing about it seems so incredible for an Irish person to have experienced so much. Can you tell me, you first left Ireland to go to India via England, is that right?
I joined the British Air Force in World War II up in Belfast in 1943, and then went to India with the Air Force. And then spent 4 years in the islands of the Indian Ocean. So that was the first time I left Ireland.
And then at some point you made a journey up to Bengal, leaving the army into the tea plantations.
Yeah, when the war came to an end, I joined a British tea company up in North Bengal, India. And I spent 5 years in that area in the tea business. That took me up until, 1953. And while I was living in North Bengal, I spent a lot of time hunting and fishing and studying wildlife, and I decided to become a big game hunter. So I walked into the country of Nepal. I walked from Darjeeling in India to Kathmandu, which is about 400 miles, and managed to get a license to open a concession for what was called trophy hunting, big game hunting in Nepal for the next 20 years.
To me, that seems like quite a big leap from the RAF to managing a tea plantation to big game hunting. How does something like that come about?
Well, when the war came to an end, I mean, none of us wanted to stay on in the British forces, so we all left. And I had spent time in India during the war. I had met tea planters there. They told me what kind of a life it was. So as soon as I left, as soon as I got back to London, I applied to several tea companies and got a job and went back. And then living in North Bengal, it was an area in those days which was full of wildlife. In the tea plantations, which were in deep forests, we had rhino, elephants, tigers, leopards. So I became intensely involved in wildlife and also in hunting. So one thing led to another, and eventually I finished up in Nepal as a big game hunter.
The impetus for this, was it adventure? Was it love of the outdoors?
It was both those things. It was adventure. It was a challenge of adventure. It was a great love of the outdoors, and also a great interest in discovery. Because when I went into Nepal, I was the second foreigner in the whole country. The person there before me was the British ambassador. And then when I went down to Western Nepal, where I set up my hunting company, I was in a place where they'd never seen a foreigner before. So it was quite fascinating. It was all new, and it was very exciting to me. I was in my 20s at the time.
So if they had never seen a foreigner, it's unlikely there were other Irish people there. Were you aware of the fact that for an Irish person it was an unusual pursuit?
Oh, yes, indeed. In the tea plantations, there were one or two Irish, a lot of Scottish, mostly British, of course. But in Nepal at that time, and after I left India, I don't think I met another Irish person for many, many years.
And clearly there wasn't much hunting going on in Donnybrook at the time. There was a pig farm, I think, on the banks of the Dodder. But otherwise, in Dundalk, had you done any hunting there?
No. Let me explain. I was born in 1925. In 1930, we left Dublin and moved to County Monaghan. My father was in the Irish Excise Service, and we bought a house and some land up in County Monaghan, a place called Annalore. And so from then until I was 18 and joined the Air Force, I lived in the Irish countryside and naturally enough became something of an outdoors person. So there was nothing in Donnybrook, of course, but most of my life, my young life, was spent in County Monaghan near a place called Clonus, up near the border.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where my interest in the outdoors really developed.
And then in Nepal, you became a professional big game hunter. Is that right? What does that involve?
Well, I spent 5 years in the tea plantations as an amateur hunter, then decided I was ready to become a pro. And being a pro hunter is running safaris. It means taking clients, hunting for trophy hunting. It's all finished. It's all in the past now. But essentially, they came out, they shot some, they shot a tiger, they shot a leopard, they shot a crocodile, and they came back and they stuffed it and put it on the wall. It was it's something from another age, if you like, now. But it was called essentially safaris or trophy hunting. That's what it was called.
And although, as you say, I mean, it seems distasteful to us at the moment, but at the time it did involve, there was a love of nature involved in it, wasn't there?
Yes, for a young man, it was very exciting life. It was well paid. It was 8 months' work a year, and then 4 months we closed down because of the monsoon and the heat, and bad time to take people hunting. And essentially it was a great life, and coming out of India, it seemed like the natural thing to do. Nowadays, it's perhaps distasteful to people to even talk about, especially children. You don't see trophy heads on the walls anymore, not in restaurants or even in clubs, perhaps. But at that time, it was the thing to do, if you like.
And why did you give up?
I gave up in 1970. I decided I'd had enough hunting. I developed an enormous respect for the animals, especially the larger animals like elephant and rhino and the big tigers and so on. And I just decided I had enough, so I went to the government and told them I was folding my tents. And I said, I have a lovely concession there. I had 200,000 acres, more actually. And I said, well, why don't we turn it into a park? And they said, we have no money. Make a long story short, I found the money, went back, and turned it into a park, a protected sanctuary, which is what it is today, to this very day.
And was that one of the first wildlife parks in Nepal?
It was the second, actually, in the country. Now there are about 15 altogether, all through the country.
So it's that idea of poacher to game hunter. It was always sort of just a phrase. Did that seem odd to you at the time, that huge turn?
No, because I liked the life very much. I liked camping out for 8 months of the year. And I realized that if I went into wildlife conservation, I'd be able to live pretty much the same kind of life, but without the clients and without the shooting, which I wasn't going to miss all that much.
Your clients, when you were hunting, would have been, at the time, I mean, it was incredibly popular with the elite and with the rich, particularly in America. What sort of people back then, in 69, the early 70s, were interested in wildlife to that degree, to the same degree as they would be interested in hunting or shooting?
Well, most of my clients were Americans from Texas, from California. And trophy hunting was incredibly popular in those days. I had foreigners. I mean, I had Europeans, German, French, English, but they were mostly Americans. And they had to be rich, of course, because it was very expensive. The fees were high. And then came the taxidermy of the animals after the hunt came to an end. And it was something that was very popular. In fact, they built enormous trophy rooms, a lot of these people did, a lot of my clients, trophy rooms that in many cases were larger than the houses that they lived in.
But as you say, you then set up the White Grass Plains Safari Lodge, where people were just admiring animals. They were going to look at animals. But it still probably, it required you getting very near to Bengal tigers, to what else at the time, to rhinoceros?
You took people out for wildlife viewing. You took them out in four-wheel drive vehicles, or I took them out on elephant back, on the backs of domestic elephants. You couldn't take them on foot. Certain animals are dangerous. Rhino are dangerous. Crocs are dangerous along the rivers. Tiger and leopard, elephant, not really dangerous. So people were taken out in, on the backs of domestic elephants or in four-wheel drive vehicles. And you got as close as you could to the animals because it was photography, video cameras, still cameras and so on.
It seems to me, to people listening, it just seems like a remarkable life, particularly for a Donnybrook boy. It's almost boy's own adventure. Were you aware of that you were living this sort of adventure, this myth during your life?
I suppose I was. It seemed quite natural to me, as one thing led to another, going to India and then becoming a tea planter. I realized it was an extraordinary life. I never wanted to do anything else except at the end of my big game hunting career, turn into conservation, which I do now and which I enjoy very much.
And was it dangerous? Is both the hunting and now the conservation, is there an element of danger involved?
There's always danger when you're shooting large wild animals and when you're wounding them. And they become very angry, they become dangerous, and they're liable to attack. Left alone, they're pretty harmless for the most part. So there was always an element of danger. And it was the hunter's job, when an animal was wounded, to go after it and make sure that it was put down, put out of its misery. So there was a certain amount of danger, but it was just viewed as par for the course. It was just the job. It was a job that it was a professional hunter's job, not just to get trophies for his clients, but to make sure that his clients stayed safe and went home safe.
Since 1970, since, as you said, you set up first the wildlife park and it has since expanded, you then, in the later 70s, went off whitewater rafting. Is that right?
Yes. In the 70s, I did a long trek across the Himalaya with some friends through the central and western Himalayan mountains and saw this gorgeous river. And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a raft? And we walked about 100 miles down this river. I came back next year with some friends again, two rafts, and we ran this river. And then I saw the possibility of commercial whitewater river running. So I formed my own company, and I ran all the big rivers and did that for 8 years. And I did first runs, first descents on five of the Himalayan rivers, first run on the Lee River in China, and a first run on the Galana-Sabaki River in the Tsavo Reserve in Kenya.
And you had no experience for this, but this was just something you built up over time. Is that right?
I had very little experience. And in the beginning, I was pretty lucky, actually, because we didn't have any accidents. Then as we went along, we learned about the dangers of whitewater. But we still never had any accidents. And it was a matter of learning as you go along. I still love rivers. I ran a river with some friends just a month ago in the Himalaya. And I'm just back from that now.
Would you mind me asking, what age are you now, Peter?
I'm, let me think now.
Yes.
I was born in 1925, which makes me 82 this year.
You're listening to The Big Adventure. I'm talking to Peter C. Byrne, a man from originally from Donnybrook who has led an incredible life. Peter, after your time setting up this wildlife park, which is still extant, which you're still involved in Nepal, you then got involved, you say, in the 70s in whitewater rafting. Was it after that you became involved in searching for the Yeti?
No, it was before that, actually. It was while I was big game hunting. I met a Texan, a man called Tom Slick, who was an oil man, a very fine man. And he asked me if I would organize some expeditions to go looking for what we call the Abominable Snowman, or the Yeti. So we went off in early 1957, and I spent 3 years in the Himalaya. Came down for Christmas in the end of 57, came down again in 58, and then came down and finished at the end of 1960. So I spent 3 years in the Himalaya.
When you talk about the Himalaya, you're talking the high Himalayas, the snowbound Himalayas, above the snow line.
Yes and no. We worked mostly from about 10,000 feet up to about 16 or 17 or 18, and the snow line varies a great deal in there. In fact, there's a lot of dense forest up in those areas, rhododendron forest and oaks and magnolias, and that's where we believe these creatures were.
And how were you able to choose the locations to look in?
Well, we chose the most remote locations possible, like central Himalaya, and then all the way into the far eastern Himalaya. And we talked to villagers and said, you know, the usual thing, have you seen anything? Have you heard of anything? We showed them pictures of gorillas, pictures of orangutans. And sometimes someone would say, oh, my father saw one of those in such and such place, or my grandfather. And we'd go to that place. So we were on the move nearly all the time for 3 years in the high Himalaya.
Did you have much luck?
Two things. One, in 57 we found two sets of footprints and photographed those, made plaster casts, tried to follow them, and were beaten back by bad weather in both cases. And then in 1958 we found a mummified hand in a monastery. And we managed to get, we got the lamas there to give us a finger off this hand, and we got that back to the U.S. for analysis, and it was analyzed. And the summary of the analysis was, it's the finger of an unknown species of some kind. So those really, in all that time, were the only two discoveries we made.
And that analysis was done 50 years ago. Has there been new analysis done with new methods on that?
Well, there could be if we knew where the finger was, but unfortunately it's been lost.
Peter, you must have written about this, haven't you, about the experience of searching for the Yeti as well as your other times.
I've written a number of articles, magazine articles, but I've written about my big game hunting years, and then I've done a book on elephants, done a book on tigers, And then recently, a book that just came out, a book about man-eating tigers. But I wrote a manuscript about the Yeti expeditions and was not able to get it published. And that's quite some time ago, and I've abandoned the idea of publishing it.
Your book on the man-eating tigers, this gentleman hunter, I was looking on it online, looks beautiful. It's part of a limited edition, isn't it? It's available, I think, only through safaripress.com. It looks gorgeous. In fact, one of the books, you seem to have been able to focus on elements of a distant world we are completely losing now. That account of those years, 1957, 1958, Ulip in the Himalayas, would make an incredible story. What were you living in then? Did you live with locals or did you have your own camping?
In the first year, we used tents and we camped in tents and we found them extremely cold, temperatures 10, 15, 20 below at times. And so we spent a lot of time living in caves. And the Himalaya has very few caves. They're mostly sort of huge cracks in the rocks or leaning rocks. But the difference between living in a cave was that you could have a campfire and sit around it in the cave. So we spent a great deal of time living like cavemen.
The other great myth about the Himalayas, as well as the presence of the Yeti, is the presence of these Buddhist monks, these immortal yogis who meditate in caves high up in the mountains for the good of mankind. Did you come across those? Is that just a myth too, or did you find fact?
I met one who was like the custodian of a cave away over in the east, and it was a limestone cave. And if you went there and crawled through the cave, you were supposed to get all sorts of heavenly merits. And I did meet this one man who lived at that cave a long, long time ago. Just the one. I never met any others.
And now, 50 years after searching for the Yeti, what are your feelings about that now? Do you think it's true?
I think it was true. I think that there was something, because it's in Buddhist literature, and then we met people, very reliable witnesses who had seen one, or their fathers had seen one, but I think it might be gone, because I spent a lot of time in Nepal now, and I talked to traders, I talked to Tibetans. No one has seen or heard anything for 25, maybe 30 years, nothing at all. It may have come to the end of its cycle, shall we say, and died out.
Yeah, there were so many different sources, as you say. I mean, there had to be some grounds to the idea. You then later got involved with the hunt for Bigfoot in the Pacific Northwest of America. How did that come about?
When we came down from the Himalaya at the end of 1960, there was a cable from our sponsors in Texas saying, would you like to come over to America and look for this, investigate this, what's called the Bigfoot mystery? And quite frankly, we laughed at the idea. We thought it was funny. But we came over, spent some time, found there was a huge area in the Pacific Northwest through Oregon, the mountain ranges, Washington, British Columbia. And we met people who said they'd seen one of these things. They're seemingly very reliable witnesses. And we found there was a history in old newspapers and magazines. So I wrote a book about it, which is called The Hunt for Bigfoot, and was published by Simon & Schuster in New York. And I spent 2 years on that. And then my principal sponsor, the man whose name I mentioned a short time ago, Tom Slick, died in an air crash, and the search came to an end.
And where were you? What were your feelings towards the end of that expedition? Did you have a sense of whether Bigfoot existed?
I had a sense there could be something. I believed many of the eyewitnesses whom I interviewed, and I saw some footprints, and I've been out of it now for a long time. But it was quite fascinating, and all I can say is, like in summary, is that there is an area enormous enough to hide a few of these things in what we call the Pacific Northwest.
You're now involved with the International Wildlife Conservation Society. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
In 1969, when I went to the Nepal government and said, let's make a park out of my concession, and they said we'd no money, I went to Washington, D.C., and with two doctors and two attorneys, I founded the International Wildlife Conservation Society. It's a registered society. And I've worked in wildlife conservation through the society for many years, recent years, putting in water holes in this park, same place where I hunted. And right now, I'm building a safari lodge out there, which is designed as a not-for-profit center and as a base for scientists doing research in the park. Through the International Wildlife Conservation Society. I've just come back from that. We're about halfway there. I hope to complete it in about 3 or 4 months. and it'll be for research in the scientifically unknown forests of the White Grass Plains, where there are all sorts of things to be discovered. So that's what I'm working on right now, and it's very exciting.
It's an incredible life, Peter. I'm talking again to Peter Byrne, originally from Donnybrook, who then went off to Bengal, eventually to Nepal, has lived an incredible life. Peter, this international wildlife conservation that you created once you had given over your hunting concession, once you'd given it back to the government and then looked after it, has now been protected for 40 years anyway. Is it a sign, is it a cause of optimism? Has it been protected? Is it pure?
It has been very well protected. The Nepalese government, in spite of recent political problems, has a very good record in wildlife conservation. One of the reasons for it is the old king, who was the father of the present king, decided years and years ago to put military posts in every wildlife park as a deterrent for poachers. And they did this. So poaching has been minimal. In the recent political upheaval, there's been some problems because there hasn't been the patrolling that there should be. But it's coming back now. And we have, in my park, we have about 32 tiger, we have 21 elephant, we have a herd of 2,000 deer, a sort of swamp deer, an endangered species, and we have rhino. About 5 years ago, I found a single rhino in there, persuaded the government to relocate rhino from another park, and at the moment we have about 14 or 15 rhino in this little park.
And do you find, is the wider world becoming more interested in this? Is it possible to make a profit from tourism of this nature?
Yes and no. The park we're talking about is very remote. It has very, very few tourists, like maybe two or three in a year.
Right.
So there's no profit in that. The other parks have developed small lodges all around them, and this may happen with my park. That may happen, in which case tourists will come down, and I suppose some sort of income will be made, some of which we hope will go back into conservation within the park.
Peter, I know that because of your involvement with the Bigfoot and Yeti, there are a lot of people were searching out that story. But for me, what is most amazing about you is that you're Irish, just because it's so unusual for people from Ireland, particularly in the 40s to in the 50s, to have gone out and explored a completely different world and got to know it, become expert at it. Or were you aware that that was an odd thing for a Donnybrook boy to do?
Not really, no. I make a joke about Donnybrook, you know. They say, you know, where are you from? And I say, Donnybrook. It's kind of a tough neighbourhood, and that's why I left. Well, that's not quite true.
I grew up in Donnybrook myself, and the Donnybrook boot boys, in fact, were quite lethal once they got their time. But it's interesting. Your new book, as we're saying, is This Gentleman Hunter, which is unfortunately not available in bookshops. Your previous books are available in bookshops, but this is only available through safaripress.com. But it tells the life of Jim Corbett, a famous man-eating tiger hunter, if that's not too long a word. But he was Irish as well. Is that right?
Corbett was what they called domiciled Irish. Corbett's grandfather was a young Irishman from Dublin, and at the age of 18, he and his wife got on a sailing ship. It's quite unbelievable, actually, in those days, because we're looking at probably about 1850, and sailed to India and joined the army in India. And then his son was Jim Corbett's father. But the family, through, say, three or four generations, were domiciled in India. So what they were called is domiciled Irish.
That sounds like a fascinating book. Peter, overall, I mean, can I ask you one final question? What amazes me about you is you're now living in Santa Monica, or near enough, you're living in California. You're jetting back and forth to this wildlife conservation park in Nepal and have incredible plans. At 80 years of age, how do you manage? Where is that energy coming from?
Well, you know, it's all a matter of good health, and good health to me is a sort of a matter of luck. If you look after yourself And I suppose I have. I never smoke, for instance. And you get to be my age and all sorts of things loom around the corner. You hope that you have a few more years. So far, it's been pretty good.
Any plans for a quiet retirement in the west of Ireland?
Certainly not.
Peter Byrne, it's been an absolute honour and a pleasure talking to you. People can find out more information about Peter's life, some of the books he's written, his International Wildlife Conservation Society, via petercbyrne.com. Thanks for listening to the Big Adventure podcast, a mixed bag media production for RTE.